call the Civil Law Committee to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum present. Is there a motion to approve the minutes from 2:14? Representative Hillstrom moves the approval of the 2:14 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Members, we've got two bills up today. One that's being brought back up from the table, Representative Wardlow's bill, and where we had left it off was we had asked both sides, the proponents, to take 25 minutes, and then the opponents to take 25 minutes. We marked it down and we reviewed the tape. The opponents had used 17 minutes, and we had to adjourn the meeting, and so there's about 8 minutes left for the opponents to finish their discussion or concerns against the bill, and then we'll open it up for committee discussion and other questions, members. And we'll start with that bill, and then we'll do Representative Anderson's bill. So Representative Wardlow, maybe give us a one-minute review of what your House File 211 is about. We'll take that from the table and have it in front of us for discussion. Refresh our memories as a committee, and then we'll let the opponents come forward.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to refresh the committee's recollection, the bill does a few things. First of all, it's a bill that's good for jobs and is meant to improve the business climate of Minnesota by reining in some of the more abusive practices with regard to class action lawsuits, consumer fraud lawsuits, etc. It puts a detrimental reliance requirement on acts brought under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, Consumer Fraud Act, and False Statement and Advertising Act, as well as an out-of-pocket loss damages threshold, which means that you have to meet the definition of out-of-pocket losses. But then once you do, you know, any plaintiff who does meet that, all theories of recovery and damages are available, and then it allows for interlocutory appeals. And Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, if you will.
Representative Wardlow, you want to move your amendment, and then we'll discuss that quick.
All right.
To note
the very
some
simple
changes.
So I move that on page 1, line 25, where it reads, and applies to actions commenced on or after that date, change the word, delete the word commenced, and insert that accrue. So it would read, lines 24 and 25, this section is effective the day following final enactment and applies to actions that accrue on or after that date.
Okay. So, Representative Wardlow, you're making an oral amendment, two words. Mr. Gehring, do you have that amendment? Sarah, do you have it for the records? Representative Wardlow moves that oral amendment. Tell us briefly what you're doing
by deleting that. Certainly, Mr. Chair. This amendment changes the effective date so it applies to, changes the statute so that it will not reach back to, with regard to actions that have triggering events that are before the effective date. Rather, it will apply only to actions, the events upon which they are based occur after the effective date.
So you're removing the retroactive language that was currently in the DE1 amendment last
time?
That's
right.
People, does everybody got that? So the people in the audience also know. Any discussion on that amendment? Otherwise, we'll get it in the shape the author desires. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying, of the Wardlow oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Representative Wardlow, I think we'll... We'll have the opposition come forward and finish their testimony to the committee.
Mr.
What we've got is there's three, Mr. Elwood, Ms. Sharon Van Dyke, and then...
Mr. Wire's not here.
Mr. Wire is not here?
Correct.
Okay, so what we've got would be just the two of you left that was on the list. So you may proceed. Thank you. If you can divide the time accordingly, we'll give you... I'll give you a notice when there's down to a minute or so left.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Van Dyke. I'm an attorney in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. I have been involved in a number of class action litigations. I've also been involved in one that wasn't, that has to do with these particular acts, Consumer Fraud Act and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And I am specifically, since you heard a lot about the first portion of the bill last time, my purpose here today is to, in particular, discuss Subdivision 3, which was not discussed last time. I have an appellate practice, and so I'm familiar with this situation. The generic description for Subdivision 3 would be the right to an interlocutory appeal. There are several problems with it that impact not only procedure and that type of thing, but frankly, the reality of how these cases progress. Number one, this is exactly the opposite of the Federal Act in terms of procedure that was passed by Congress in 2005, which was the fairness, you know, the Class Action Fairness Act, and apparently the whole country thought, at least the majority at that time under President Bush, thought that that was the proper procedure to make it fair. We would be, in effect, making Minnesota totally different than the rest of the country, and frankly, treating Minnesotans who want to bring a local class action for local business in a way that's much more difficult for them than for anybody else. And I question if we really want to do that. The second thing, with respect to interlocutory appeals, right now, if there's a really good reason to appeal a class certification, which is usually when a business or a company who's been sued under one of these acts wants to do it, there's a discretionary right of the trial judge to do that. Most of the time it's not appealable. Some of them do go up. The way this is written, there's an absolute right to go up to the Court of Appeals after multiple actions. If the class is certified, then the plaintiffs would go up. I guarantee you they're probably not going to do that. An order refusing to certify a class can go up right away. Denying a motion to decertify a class can go up right away. What you have is yo-yo. I get the court declines to certify, you know, the court certifies a class. You go up, you come down. You take a few more depositions, do a little more discovery. Oh, there's a motion denying. You want it, the business brings a motion to decertify the class. Oops, that goes up, comes down. There's no end to it. You end up with 2, 3, 4, 5 appeals in one action. That's expensive, not only to both parties, but also to the courts. There's a rule of unitary appeal for a very good reason. It goes up, the Court of Appeals has all of the record, all of the evidence, and can make one decision with everything in mind, with fairness for all. The other thing I want to address that really concerns me, and I think would concern a lot of people in litigation, whether they're a business or a regular person, is if you're a plaintiff in one of these actions, and, or frankly, either direction, and you go up on appeal, this bill contains a stay of discovery. An appeal takes year to a year and a half, assuming it doesn't go up to the Supreme Court, in which you're talking 2 to 2.5 years. During that time, no discovery can occur. Now, last week we heard testimony that, well, these businesses, you know, they're not gonna get rid of evidence, they're not gonna hide evidence, you know, everything will still be there. I can tell you from personal experience that that's simply not the case. Number one, if a business is getting sued for fraud or deceptive trade practices, we're not talking about businesses who are behaving in an upfront manner here. In order to have a case where those things are alleged, unless you are literally violating the rules of ethics, there is good reason to believe that they're engaging in fraud and deception to start with. The fact is, the longer the delay from the time in which you start the suit, and discovery commences where you get the discovery you're entitled to, both ways, to the point at which you're done with discovery, stuff disappears. Witnesses don't remember. They get old. They die. They move. You can't find them. Documents that should have been preserved, either someone destroyed them or they got mistakenly shredded, and that happens all the time in a big company because they have document retention procedures that require things to go after 6 months. And somebody who doesn't know what's going on because it's been 4 years ago and they were hired 2 years ago pushes the shredder button. And that's not talking about the fact that we're talking about a cause of action that deals with fraud and deception. All you have to do to know that some businesses, certainly not all, I mean, the reality is that as many businesses have been plaintiffs in these cases as defendants. Because of the, there are at least as many businesses, smaller businesses suing larger businesses. What you're basically saying is putting the one suing the other one at a disadvantage and arguing that the one that's being accused of deception, misrepresentation, and fraud would never get rid of evidence. And I'm telling you that I'm one of the attorneys on that Anoka BNSF case where $4 million in sanctions were issued against BNSF because we proved to a very conservative judge that all kinds of deceptive practices during discovery did indeed go on.
2 minutes.
So what I'm telling you is that with respect to Subdivision 3, it's expensive in terms of time and energy. It's going to cost the courts more. It's frankly unfair, and it's not pro-business.
Thank you, Ms. Van Dyke. Mr. Elwood, do you have a brief comment as well?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I do appreciate the opportunity before the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. First of all, I want to thank Representative Wardlow. He spent a lot of time with me discussing my concerns and the amendment that he put on last week. I think, you know, demonstrated some responsiveness. And so, although he's not here, I wish he were here to hear this. So, if you could all could tell him. Oh, I'm sorry. There he is. So, all right. I just have a couple of brief comments.
Okay.
You know, I think
about 1 minute. So
we're all. I talk really fast on it. So we're all looking for balance, and I think that what happens, what this bill does, is further skew the balance that was skewed in 2000 by the Lee decision that essentially removed the right of individual actions in consumer fraud cases. So now we're taking another step, creating what is likely an insurmountable bar, and skewing the balance even further. Class actions are as much to compensate victims as to deter bad behavior. I've always, whenever I bring a bill, everybody asks me, well, what to worry about unintended consequences. I would argue that potentially an unintended consequence here would be to, in the hope of creating a better business climate, you would in fact be creating a favorable climate for fraudulent operators to come in here. And finally, I would suggest to you that here we are in a situation with the budget crisis where it is definite possibility here that we're going to be reducing the resources of the Attorney General and the Department of Commerce to enforce these kinds of acts. So this is not the time to be reducing the ability of private citizens to enforce these laws. In fact, we should be doing the opposite since we're going to be reducing public resources that are going to be devoted to that very cause. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, and that is right on the mark. So, members, we'll be at the discussion mode right now, so if you have questions, let John know and we'll call on you. Representative Simon first. Or questions for these witnesses would be appropriate at this time.
Not for these witnesses. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Well, any of it, Representative Simon. Is there any questions for Mr. Elwood or Ms. Van Dyke? Representative Runhagen.
Never been called that before.
And Grunbeck. Representative. Representative Runbeck and then Representative Grunhagen.
Ms. Van Dyke, just I didn't catch all you said about the BNSF case, but is that relevant to this that we're discussing, which has to do with, class action?
Thank you for the question.
It doesn't seem like, maybe it is. It didn't seem
Van Dyke.
Like class action.
Thank you for the question. It deals with the idea of staying discovery and what happens when you stay discovery. And there is a mandatory stay of discovery in Subdivision 3 of this Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reason for my comment, because of one of the comments made last week when this bill came up, that good businesses don't do things like get rid of evidence. And the reality is they do. Some do because they do it on purpose. Some do inadvertently, but they do. And that was the relevance. It has to do with staying discovery, which is in this bill in Subdivision 3.
Thank you.
Representative Runbeck? No. Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Van Dyke, so based on your testimony, are you here opposing the bill as a whole and this section in particular, but you're willing to work with Representative Wardlow to address your concerns? Or are you here in terms of constructive criticism, or are you here opposing the bill as a whole?
Had we been all together, and thank you for the question, I would have been a piece. I didn't want to repeat what was said last week. I oppose the bill. I'm always willing to work with the author of a bill to get rid of offending, things that I consider to be unfair or, frankly, have unintended consequences. We're willing to do that. But I do oppose the whole bill. I just didn't want to repeat the stuff about detrimental reliance and those things because you heard it last week.
Yep. Mr. Chair, just follow up. I'm interested in hearing Representative Wardlow's response to the allegations or statements that have been made in terms of the concerns of his bill. I don't know if that's now or...
Representative Wardlow, could you respond for Representative Grunhagen?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen. I'll defer to Mr. Jim O'Neill to respond to those concerns first.
Mr. O'Neill, if you can identify yourself for the record.
Sure. My name is Jim O'Neill, and I'm a lawyer from the Fagerie & Benson Law Firm, and a big part of my practice is defending consumer fraud class actions. There were a number of points that were raised. I'll try to respond as best I can recall them. There was a reference both by the gentleman today and by Prentice Cox last week to the public benefit defense, which a federal court decision has applied to individual actions under the State Consumer Fraud Act, the implication being that that greatly limits the ability of individuals to bring consumer fraud action. We should allow class actions to be more freely brought. The fact is that the Minnesota Supreme Court has not spoken on that, and it is unclear whether that defense will become a permanent part of Minnesota law. Perhaps more importantly, if you don't like that public benefit ruling, it is within this legislature's power to change it. You can put something in the act that addresses that. That can be addressed on its own merits. It does not seem to me that that is a reason to oppose a bill which fundamentally, I think, seeks to prevent things that are happening where large classes of people who don't even know about the lawsuit, who may not have any injury, any damages, and were not, in fact, damaged by conduct of the defendant, are an exposure that presents a threat to the defendant requiring settlement. And I know that those cases are out there because I'm defending them. Was there a question? Secondly, Sharon talked about the provision with respect to interlocutory appeal, and as I think was also pointed out last week, The federal rule does provide a specific provision for interlocutory appeal at the discretion of the federal courts of appeals. Actually, in Minnesota, you can ask for an interlocutory appeal of a class certification ruling. There are specific standards that the Minnesota Supreme Court has told us should be applied to requests for interlocutory appeal. I tried to explain last week that I believe those standards are kind of loaded against the acceptance of interlocutory appeals of class action decisions. And while some such interlocutory appeals have been granted, many are denied, and that's the reason that I believe this is a reasonable provision of the bill. With respect to the yo-yo business, I don't really see an incentive. As was pointed out, there's expense on both sides connected with needless and frivolous appeals. There are also rules in place in the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure against the filing of frivolous appeals. So if one makes up a reason to make another decertification motion, there are reasons why you can be sanctioned for that and why your client wouldn't want you to do it, because you're spending a bunch of money to make a motion and an appeal that's only going to tick off the court and isn't going to do you any good. With respect to the document retention business, that seems to me quite a stretch, because there has been a developing body of law about spoliation and the sanctions available for the destruction of electronic documents, such that there is a standard and practice with respect to the retention of documents, which may be followed, which may not be followed, but if it's not followed, there are strong sanctions available. In fact, many plaintiffs' lawyers would prefer you to spoliate evidence, because it actually becomes a bargaining point for them in the case. But regardless, the imposition of a stay does not seem to me to materially increase the likelihood, if somebody's going to violate the rules with respect to preserving evidence, they're going to do it pretty darn fast rather than waiting for it. And then the last point I want to make, there were some questions indicating, well, fraudsters are going to benefit from this, and what is the incentive for people not to commit fraud? Many of these class actions are against some of our most well-established long-standing businesses. I won't get into what difference that makes, if any, other than to say the fact that a party is sued in a consumer fraud action in no means means they are a fraudster or should somehow be regarded in disrespect, because most every major company in this state has been sued, and most in the country have been sued in such actions. There is no shortage of ways for companies to get sued if, in long-term violation of their own economic interests, they lie to their customers. I started making a list. Truth in Lending Act, Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, securities fraud class actions, third-party payor cases, breach of warranty claims, strict liability claims, failure to warn claims, common law fraud, negligence and negligence misrepresentations, breach of contract actions, civil and criminal penalties from agencies like the FDA, the EPA, the FTC, and HUD, antitrust cases, actions by the State Attorney General and the Department of Justice. I'm sure there are many, many others that implicate various companies in varying ways. So what this bill is addressed to is trying to limit the ability of bringing a class action in behalf of people who don't even know what's going on and who have not suffered any damages because of the conduct of the defendant, and then being unable to get an interlocutory appeal of a certification decision, and having a gun to your head when you have to decide about trying such a case, because it's generally much less dangerous and acceptable to your board of directors and your auditors and the other people that businesses have to report to to settle one of these things than to take the risk of going to a jury on a case that could be huge.
Mr. Chair, Representative, just to follow up, Gruenhagen, follow up, and then Representative Mahoney and Representative Simon.
So, Mr. Neal, I conclude based on your testimony that you see no need for making any changes to the wording in the bill.
Candidly, I think the out-of-pocket loss language could be reworded a little bit because I don't think it's as clear as it should be. I think the gentleman who testified last week was correct on that. I haven't really anything to suggest. And as I said last week, I never heard of this bill until a little more than a week ago, and I haven't been involved with it until last week's testimony. But the out-of-pocket loss language could be clarified because I think it is unclear.
Mr. Gruenhagen, so are you willing to work with the author and the concerns that were raised to come up with wording on that,
sure,
to address that? Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering who handed out this U.S. Tort Liability Index.
We did, yes.
The Sarah Palin Forward.
Representative Mahoney, I understand Bob Johnson from the Insurance Federation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And for the request of last week.
Thank you. If I could just make a quick comment here. I mean, I'm looking over it on page 34, 35. You know, and Garrison Keel is correct. We're average. We're right in the middle on overall rankings, auto loss, farm owners loss, commercial multi-peril loss. Actually, we're a little bit on the good side on other liability losses. Homeowners losses were a little on the bad side. But so my question to the author of this bill, are you expecting to be exceptional or you don't like average?
Representative Mahoney, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, of course we always strive to be exceptional, and we're seeking here to make Minnesota a place where businesses are not threatened by outrageous and difficult class action lawsuits and situations where they have to face the risk of large, potentially large jury awards at the salary and expenses related to that. So, of course, we're seeking to be exceptional. That said, this being in the middle of the pack here is not necessarily a good thing.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Mahoney.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Wardlow, after 10 years of working with hundreds and thousands of small companies, I just want you to understand tort liability has never, ever come up. Never. In the life sciences, in medical devices, in manufacturing, none of those, and I meet with them regularly. I have lunch with them, I have breakfast with them, to sit down and talk about the issues that they are concerned about. And not once in 3 years of doing those things have any of these, almost 100 that I've sat down and had lunch and breakfast with, said anything about tort liability.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple comments and then some questions. First of all, I think it's important for members and the public to know when it comes to class actions, I understand, based on what's on the news, based on the handouts here, it's easy to snicker at coupon settlements where people get a dollar for late blockbuster fees. But you got to keep in mind, the reason you have class action lawsuits is I think that we would all admit that if a business stole or defrauded someone out of $1 million, that would be wrong. We'd all agree that with that. What if a billion defrauds 1 million people out of a dollar each? Isn't that the same wrong? That's the idea of a class action. No one's going to go out and file their own lawsuit to get a buck back, or $3, or $20, or probably a couple $1,000. But sometimes you have wrongdoers, corporate or otherwise, who steal a little bit of money from a lot of people, and that's the idea of a class action. It's not some illegitimate scheme. It's a very legitimate and long-standing practice. So I just want to make sure we all understand the reason. It's just not a bunch of huckster lawyers out there trying to make money. As I said during one of the overviews that we had at the beginning of session here, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm concerned about the movement that calls itself tort reform, because in part that's kind of a Rorschach inkblot test. It's whatever you want it to be and whatever you look at it. People have different impressions. But I'm fascinated by the fact that the concern with this bill and the tenor I'm sensing so far this session is with only one kind of lawsuit. It's with individuals suing larger entities, not, as one of the testifiers said, entities suing entities. Now, I know of what I speak because it's what I do for a living. I'm in the business litigation department of a law firm in Minneapolis. So what I do is I represent businesses, sometimes as plaintiffs, sometimes as defendants, who sue each other over business disputes. And if you look at the Court of Appeals website or the Supreme Court website, and you go down the list of cases, published and unpublished, you will see a ton of those kinds of disputes. That's where the money is. That's what takes up a lot of the court's time, apart from the criminal docket, but within the civil docket. And I don't see any objection here whatsoever in this bill to those. I handed out to you here, this is from me, members, this newspaper article from last week's Star Tribune. I knew this bill was coming up, and I tore it out. Here's an example of a David v. Goliath situation where David, fortunately, was a local company, a Plymouth company, that just got a $125 million settlement from the Murdoch firm. I don't see anyone objecting to this. I don't see anyone saying that this kills jobs. In fact, it probably helps the job situation in Minnesota. We have a Plymouth company that's $125 million richer. No one's complaining about that. No one's saying that that's bringing down the system. But I have a feeling that if this were Murdoch has to play $125 million class action judgment, where every plaintiff gets a $10 coupon for something, then people would be up in arms. I just want to put things in perspective here and understand the need for consistency. What I am hearing in this bill and the tenor of this session so far is that what we're really after is people, individuals, who have a claim against some larger entity, usually a business, but not always, and that we seem totally unconcerned. I'm not saying we should be concerned, but a lot of folks seem who are concerned with the first scenario seem totally unconcerned with this scenario. So, you know, I understand this is the real face of our court system. And this is what my day-to-day life outside of the legislature is, although I can't say I've had a $125 million settlement. I can tell you that much. But that's what goes on out there. So I looked at, you know, last time, it's probably still in our packet this time, there's this list of Minnesotans for lawsuit reform. Apart from noticing that there are 19 bowling alleys listed, I also noticed, I just did a little homework assignment, and I went on the Court of Appeals website in Minnesota, and I only looked at the published cases. The unpublished are, you know, 10 times as many. I looked at the published cases only. And I wanted to see, wouldn't it be interesting if some of the members of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform actually were plaintiffs in business-on-business lawsuits? I didn't even look. I only looked at the first case caption, if they're the appellant, not even if they're the respondent. So I did a very cursory review, and you know what I found just on this list? General Mills, Golden Valley, recently sued Gold Medal Insurance Company in an insurance dispute, saying that they were owed money from their insurance. PeopleNet of Minnetonka, which is on this list, in 2010, very recently, sued Balon Ventures. Keep in mind, this is only the published cases. I haven't even looked at the unpublished yet. I think that's a good assignment for some of our research folks. Travelers Insurance, just in the last few years, sued Bloomington Steel. It was a declaratory judgment action regarding indemnification. And Wells Fargo, of course, is involved in a lot of lawsuits, but one where they were a plaintiff. They sued in 2003 having to do with a mortgage foreclosure. This is just the Court of Appeals, just the published opinions. My point is that most of the litigation that goes on out there is business versus business. So one of these 19 bowling alleys might sue one another for deceptive trade practices, might sue one another for an antitrust violation, might sue an insurer, might sue a supplier. That is what happens every day in our court system, and yet I'm not hearing a peep for most folks about that. It's only individuals we're going after, the farmer, the barber, the secretary, who, by him or herself or along with others, has a claim against some larger entity, usually but not always a business. That's who we're really after here. We're going to go after those folks, but it's okay if Insignia, a firm in Plymouth, has a beef with Murdoch's, one of Murdoch's companies. That's apparently okay with us. I don't understand it. I want to talk about Section 3 of the bill on decertification abuse. Again, I've dealt with motions for decertification. And Mr. O'Neill says, well, there are all sorts of protections in place, and people aren't going to go up and down on decertification. And just so everyone knows, getting class certification is a very hard thing to do. The burden is on the plaintiffs to prove a number of things, but primarily three. One is you've got to prove numerosity. if it's just Representative Hortman and I and we think Blockbuster has screwed us, that's not enough for a class action. You got to show that you've got a substantial number of people. Another one is typicality. Let's say it's Hortman and Simon versus Blockbuster. We've got to show that the two of us as named plaintiffs are typical of the class that we purport to represent. And finally, I mean, there are other factors. One of the factors is commonality. That is, not only are we typical, but the injury that we allege was done to us is common to the class. There's one thread that's woven throughout the whole class. Those are just three of many, many other hurdles that you have to jump over. So it's a hard thing to do. It doesn't mean you won the case. It means the judge has said you can go forward in this kind of entity, a class action. So you go through a lot of time, effort, energy, and money over a number of years, and let's say a group of plaintiffs overcomes that very high hurdle, that very high burden, and does get certified as a class. You haven't won anything yet. Judge and the court hasn't said that your case is good, bad, or otherwise. They've just said you've proven that you are a class. You're a cognizable, recognizable class. Under this bill, you could automatically halt the litigation. The defendant or defendants could appeal to the Court of Appeals, and I don't even have a problem with interlocutory or automatic appeals. Just me personally, I could possibly support that. But then you have a stay of discovery so that all the asking questions of witnesses or hunting around for documents, that is frozen. That is totally stopped for a period, as Ms. Van Dyke said, of a year or two, if you're lucky, maybe even longer, pending appeal. In my experience and observation, it's not that people are scheming and evil and trying to cover up bad evidence. That's not it, although in the BNSF case, that did apparently happen. I think the more typical case is that you have large entities, they're big places. Sometimes they have document destruction policies that call for emails to be destroyed after a certain period of time, or documents to be destroyed, or employees leave, or they die, or they get disabled, or they forget. And to stay discovery during this time puts a huge thumb on the scale. For a defendant who, by the way, in court has already lost. Not the case, but the defendant saying you're not a class. The plaintiff has overcome all these hurdles. They finally got class action status. The burden is on the defendant, and the defendant gets to say, hands off. You can't talk to any of our people for a year or two. You can't look at any of our documents for a year or two. Even though you won, we're the ones appealing, we the corporation. You can't do anything for a year or two. That's just not fair, members. I don't know of any other context where we're doing that. And what this bill is doing through this and other mechanisms is saying we're going after the farmer, the barber, the everyday person. But when Insignia does it, doesn't matter. It's just the individual going after a larger entity. That's what we're going after here. I have a question, but what I'd really like to have, Mr. Chair, this is a little unconventional. I'm wondering if Ms. Van Dyke can respond, since she's a practitioner in this particular area, to a couple things that Mr. O'Neill has said with regard to the rules and the protections that he said were in place in terms of going up and down and up and down on these decertification motions. Before I do that, just a note of explanation. I know I'm going from point to point here pretty quickly, but so let's say that a class has been certified. Under this bill, you could have multiple motions for decertification. So there's already been a certification. Not only can they appeal certification, but they can affirmatively move, not just we think the court was wrong, we're appealing certification. They can affirmatively and offensively make a motion for decertification at any point in the lawsuit. I've had personal experience with this kind of motion. So what you can do, let's say the judge rested her opinion of certification on the testimony of three people. They said, because of witness A, witness B, and witness C, we think that there is sufficient commonality, numerosity, typicality, and all the other things to certify a class. Three people. These three people, deadly, devastating testimony. And let's say after certification, the defendant takes the deposition, the sworn statement under oath, of witness A, cuts up witness A's testimony, then goes to the court and says, on the strength of this deposition of witness A, we're going to move for decertification. Doesn't talk yet to witness B or witness C necessarily. Certification goes up. Everything's frozen. You take a year to decide the motion, maybe, with appeals and everything else. Then it goes down again. And then they depose witness B, same thing, same year. Witness C, same thing, same year, and on and on and on. I understand Mr. O'Neill saying there's no incentive to do that. I would beg to differ. In some cases, there's a real incentive to do that, because you know that the defendant knows that it has the deeper pockets than the plaintiff's law firm, and it can just, you know, bleed the plaintiff's law firm to death. They know this is very expensive. and that most class action law firms won't have the financial wherewithal to last very long. So we just have a difference of opinion based on my experience. So decertification is another issue, not just appealing certification, but affirmatively moving in the district court to decertify. I'm very troubled by that. I think it'll be extremely wasteful. You could have a zigzag up and down yo-yo kind of deal going on and on and on and on, and talk about a waste of resources. I think very often there is a real incentive to do that. I just think there are a lot of problems with this bill. I understand, Representative Wardlow, I think you're coming from a good place. You, like all the rest of us, are concerned about jobs and productivity in Minnesota. I don't doubt your motives. I don't question them. I just think in practice I'm really worried that we're going after everyday people here. Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge it, could we hear just briefly from Ms. Van Dyke if she has any comments to Mr. O'Neill's testimony?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon, I would, but I'd like to Representative Wardlow might have a response to yours, if we can just interject in between, and then we'll ask Ms. Van Dyke to come up for your question or questions.
Thank you, Representative Wardlow. And thank you, Representative Simon, for your comments. As you know, we're not going after individuals here or small. We're not going after individuals. We're not going after anyone. And we're also, and of course, civil litigation between businesses, between individuals, between an individual and a business, is all okay and fine. The problem is there is a certain category of class action lawsuits. In particular, class actions brought under the acts listed here, which, of course, are just three different statutory causes of action that are particularly prone to creating situations where defendants have to pay or face unreasonable risks. And we're trying to make sure that those risks are taken in a little bit, make sure our court system is not wasting judicial resources dealing with these kinds of class actions brought under these acts when they could be, like you said, handling all the other kinds of litigation that go on in our court systems. And secondly, as to certification, Mr. O'Neill has any comments on the motion to decertify?
Well,
Mr. O'Neill.
Just real quickly, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I already really talked about the interlocutory appeal, but I will say that interlocutory appeal is now available, and one can make the petition for an interlocutory appeal. This is intended to remove sort of the thumb from the scale on those decisions and make it clear that there should be appellate review of such decisions. With respect to the stay provision, Mr. Wardlow amended the original act and provides that the trial court, not necessarily the Court of Appeals, the trial court can lift the stay at his or her discretion. With respect to the Insignia case, that was under antitrust and unfair competition laws. I think there were a number of comments made that don't really relate to this bill, which is intended not to get at anybody except to prevent a situation where people can use unknown class members who were not damaged or injured to create a huge threat against a company.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Representative Simon, we'll have Ms. Van Dyke come up. And members, I just want to, it's about quarter after one right now. The chair does intend to vote on this, and I'm going to aim for 1:45 or sooner to vote on this. So please try to target the questions and make best use of our time. So
thank you, and thank you for your indulgence in allowing me to respond. I just have a couple brief responses. One has to do with the mention that there are court rules in place to deal with abuses of interlocutory appeals and that type of thing. There are already court rules in place to deal with inappropriate use of the class certification process. If there's a frivolity going on in terms of the plaintiff bringing a claim, whether that plaintiff is a business or a person, there are rules in place to sanction for that. Basically, what we're doing here, if we're looking at it globally, is that we are legislating court rules. And the court is a co-equal branch of government.
that has rules in place for dealing with all of this. And they have a process by which, if it's a problem, they change them. In fact, the court rules change darn near every year. So that cuts both ways, and I think we ought to be thinking long and hard, given the fact that there are already procedures in place that the court has the power to change if they feel that they need to take care of abuses, no matter which side those abuses come from. The other thing that I want to, and that kind of goes in the category, if it's not broken, don't fix it. If it is broken, the place to fix procedure is through the court rulemaking process. They're pretty darn good at it. They've been doing it for years. The other correction and clarification I want to make is that Mr. has to do with the Lee decision, and what we're talking about is the public purpose doctrine, because that, as you heard last week, is something that has really changed Minnesota into making class action almost the only way that these statutes can be used. It's really taken the right of an individual business or the right of an individual person, unless they can prove a public purpose for someone other than themselves, they have no case. The vast majority of dismissals right now, because of that decision, are because it's just me and Mr. Simon and you, Mr. Chairman, and there's only three of us in this person or business, only defrauded the three of us. And because we don't have a public purpose, we get dismissed. The Lee decision is not a federal decision. Mr. O'Neill said it was, and it's not applicable. It does not binding on the Minnesota Supreme Court. It is a Minnesota Supreme Court decision from 2000. So it is binding on all Minnesota courts. So right now, if one business, a small business, I think somebody said they used an example of a taco shop, gets defrauded by unfair trade practices and deceptive advertising by somebody across the street, unless he can prove that advertising is statewide and that what he's going to do is going to benefit everybody, he doesn't have a claim already. The only thing he can do is bring a class action. And I wanted to make it clear that the Lee decision is Minnesota Supreme Court, and it is binding on Minnesota. And that's the environment in which all of this has to be taken into account. Thank you.
Representative Simon, follow-up?
No.
That's it. Representative Lesch, and then Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the author. I'm trying to recall in the last time we were here talking about this, which feels like a long time ago, that if I had a claim and I went through a public agency, this bill would not apply, right? Because they're excluded. Like, for example, the Attorney General's office.
Representative Wardlow?
Representative Lesch, I believe that's correct.
Well, Mr. Chair, is there anyone else who can confirm that for us, just to be sure, because my question kind of hinges on whether that's true or not.
Mr. O'Neill, or
I'm sorry, could you state it again?
Come up to the
if
table,
the AG
please.
Brings an action under this, they don't have to worry about this, right? This only applies to private.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misheard your question. Yes, that's correct. Okay. This applies to the private attorney general statute.
Right, okay.
Right, so we're amending section 8.31.
Okay, thank you. Then, Mr. Chair, follow up if I may.
Representative Lesch.
In light of that, if we're shifting, I mean, the whole point of the private attorney general statute was not be a burden on government so that individuals could bring suits on their own, and that way, lighten the load against what would presumably be the job of the government in order to root out and solve problems related to fraud. So if those aggrieved parties now have to line up at the door of an already burdened attorney general's office, do you have a fiscal note to address that increase in costs for government?
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Representative Lesch, Mr. Chair. Actually, first of all, the private attorney's general statute, you're right, it does have a deterrent effect, and it was meant to supplement the attorney general statute and these acts formerly enforceable by the attorney general alone, I believe in most instances, such that there is more of a deterrent effect, but it also provides these private remedies under these different actions. And what we're trying to do here is make sure that that piece of it, the private remedies piece, as opposed to the additional deterrent piece, does not consume overly large amounts of court resources. So, in fact, by limiting these private remedies under these particular causes of actions or these particular acts, the three listed here, we're going to be saving the courts money. In addition, the interlocutory appeals part of the bill, by allowing a class certification decision order to be appealed as a matter of right, we will be preventing a good number of unnecessary, perhaps, jury trials and district court discovery, litigation, things like that. Automatic stay of discovery should save money as well.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch.
Well, if I may, then, if it's your claim that you're going to book a savings on this, then it still should have a fiscal notice to go to Representative Smith's committee. So do you plan on having that, or why do we not know about that now?
Representative Lesch, two things. It is, the motion is to refer it to judiciary. Secondly, to shed a little light on the Attorney General, their authority is discretionary, and so just like now, they'll take cases as they decide to or not decide to, and one of the reasons they would take it is if they have attorneys sitting around looking for something to do or not, and so I think nothing will change on that front, but certainly it's going to Representative Smith's committee if there's an issue regarding what you're just asking about. Representative Wardlow can have that discussion with Chair Smith.
Mr. Chair? I appreciate you providing some air cover for the chief author here, but my question specifically relates to the costs associated with it, because if we're talking, the question here that I think some people in this room are wondering is, what's the point? I mean, are we really looking at saying, okay, we're just going to chill the effects of these lawsuits so people who would otherwise have causes of actions now shouldn't have causes of action? And if that's the case, well, let's just be upfront. People are going to be left without a remedy now. But if we're talking about saying, oh, don't worry about it, the Attorney General can take care of this, well, then there's a cost factor, hence my question. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Lesch and Representative Wardlow can respond, but I think, as we've heard in the testimony, I mean, there are two aspects that are changing, primarily dealing with, if you haven't had any detrimental reliance or economic loss, you wouldn't be able to bring a case where currently you may be able to. Representative Wardlow, is that,
if you yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesch, this bill doesn't change anything about what the Attorney General will be doing, and it doesn't change, and so it doesn't affect costs for the Attorney General's office whatsoever. And with regard to your comment that it would leave people without a remedy, that's not true. It only affects these three causes of actions brought under these three statutes, and in particular with regard to the requirement of detrimental reliance and the threshold of out-of-pocket loss. It does not affect, for example, a class action that might be brought on the basis of common law fraud or securities fraud or any of the other things listed by Mr. O'Neill, amongst other causes of action.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's kind of taking us back a little bit to a comment about how we were kind of average and you would like to be extraordinary. What we're going to be, if this bill becomes law, is extraordinary in protecting businesses who are taking advantage of folks who don't otherwise have a voice and need to become a class action to get what was wrongfully taken from them. And so I don't think that going in the direction of being extraordinarily protective of businesses who are doing wrong to our consumers is the right thing for Minnesota.
Representative Pepin, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to point out to and remind members of the committee that it's my understanding that staff has, because of the workload, has specifically requested that bills not get fiscal note, they not be sent for analysis for a fiscal note until they are actually in the possession of a finance committee, because obviously if they would do a whole bunch of work on something, for example, there was a bill that came to my committee that had right to work stuff in, they would have, by the time it got to the next committee, that language was taken out. So it's my understanding that that staff is trying to avoid doing fiscal notes until it's actually in a finance committee that can act on that.
Okay. Any other comments, Representative Pavanaugh? Any other questions, members? Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for the author, Representative Wardlow. I'm wondering which cases that have been decided under this statute you're specifically concerned about. You've made a number of statements that these three statutes are particularly prone to leading to outrageous cases where there's no harm and yet there's horrific attorney's fees awarded. And I'm just wondering if you can review some of the major cases that have been decided in Minnesota under this statute and how your bill would change their outcome.
Representative Wardlow, do you have the cases memorized on the top of your head?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hortman. Well, I don't have a list of cases, as the Chair says, memorized. We do know that there are cases barred under these statutes. And Mr. O'Neill, I think, can provide you with a little bit more insight.
Mr. O'Neill.
Well, one example that comes to my mind right now, and it's a pending active case, so the details, some of them I can't really get into, but a class was certified in federal court in Minnesota, and it is currently on appeal to the Eighth Circuit. It's under Minnesota law, and it is about a construction product with what we contend is a small failure rate. The plaintiff has an expert who says the failure rate is actually going to be large, and therefore we are liable to replace every one of these products wherever they may be because they were defective. And the issue really is one that I'm talking about in terms of fairness. We're not depriving people of all remedy because if people are damaged, as I've indicated, there are lots of ways they can seek remedy. But I am concerned about people who have products who haven't failed, who can be added to the statistics on the exposure and threaten the company with damages to people who haven't been damaged.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm just very interested in us doing fact-based legislating and that we don't legislate in response to generic concerns and that when we make statements in favor of our bills urging their adoption, that we're not just making general statements of a certain belief system, such as lawyers make too much money or there are too many lawsuits. I think those statements aren't particularly helpful. What's helpful is to know, is there some sort of epidemic of cases where businesses are being dragged into court unjustly? And when I read the reported cases under these statutes and look at some of the major decisions, the tobacco litigation, I look at the Marvin Windows case, I look at Pop Telecom versus American Sharecom, lots of cases, consumers versus insurance companies, consumers versus car dealerships, consumers versus mortgage companies, consumers versus banks. And I'm looking for problems in the reported cases that cry out for a legislative solution, and I'm not seeing that. I'm particularly concerned about the detrimental reliance language, because I remember a very large case, I believe brought by Legal Aid in the mid-90s, against landlords. And what the landlords were doing was taking a tenant application fee, whether or not they had an apartment. So they were making a lot of money. Now, if you went in there and you applied for an apartment, and they took your money, you assumed they had a vacancy. So you were out $25. Were you going to be able to prove detrimental reliance? Were you going to be able to prove that particular apartment manager in that particular place made you believe there was an apartment there to get your $25? No, but this was a significant problem. It was an especially large problem for low-income people for whom $25 is a big deal. And the bringing the suit changed the practice and stopped, to the degree we could, landlords from ripping off tenants in that particular way. So, I am not seeing any particular case in Minnesota that says we should change the law, but I do know of particular cases where consumers have benefited because of the law the way it is. So if the author has any other cases that I might not be aware of that make a good argument for this bill, I would love to hear about it.
Representative Wardlow, any additional comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fortman, first I'll refer to the list of cases that we did hand out. Now, these aren't under Minnesota law in all cases, but you have to remember this bill has more than one component. We have the section that deals with just causes of actions, individual or class actions brought under the Unlawful Trade Practices, Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act, and the False Statement and Advertising Act. We also have the interlocutory appeals piece, which, of course, would apply to any class action. So it has very broad appeal. Broad application. Now, there is a hole in the law. There is a piece that's missing. The causation piece under case law, as I'm sure you're aware, is very loose. Right now, you don't need to do much to connect the alleged practice, at least with regard to these statutes we're looking at here, and any ultimate damages to recover them. And in my view, I don't believe that we should have a court system where people that can't prove that damages were necessarily caused by the act they're complaining of should be able to have recovery. And again, we're looking here at abuses of these statutes and class actions where the attorneys are the ones that are making, you know, and of course being a civil litigator, this isn't necessarily in my interest to say, but where the attorneys are making a lot of money on the cases, and as cited in some of the examples you have on the sheets in front of you, the plaintiffs, who may or may not know about the class action and what's going on at all, are getting coupons or nominal awards. And this, to address Representative Simon's earlier comment, there is a difference between one person being damaged significantly to the tune of, you know, $1,000, $100,000, $1 million, whatever it may be, and a million people having a very nominal loss, you know, having their grass cut slightly less efficiently because a lawnmower, for instance, actually had 4.95 horsepower as opposed to 5. There is a difference because the sum total of all those injuries does not equal a single injury of, you know, so calculated the same way. So,
Mr. Chair, just two
Representative Hartman.
Concluding points. One, most of the cases on these sheets that you've passed out aren't from Minnesota. The vast majority are not from Minnesota. And the other point to make about the handout is most of them weren't brought under these statutes, so I don't know that any of them support your argument that we should pass this bill. And you, in your initial response to my question, said you don't need to do much. Well, I don't know if you've ever brought a Consumer Fraud Act claim in front of a judge, but you do need to do something. You need to convince the judge that your client is entitled to relief. And I don't know if you've ever asked a judge for attorney's fees before, but judges aren't too keen on providing damages for people who have not suffered damages, and they are especially not in favor of awarding attorney's fees, even to legal aid lawyers, who probably should get them more often than private sector lawyers. But it is a very difficult bar to reach to convince a judge to give relief to your client, and it is an even higher bar to reach to convince a judge to give you attorney's fees.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, I know time is of the essence here, but I'm just to Mr. O'Neill and Representative Wardlow. I was involved in one of these so-called class action lawsuits. It happens to do with the internet stock that I bought. It dropped dramatically after it went up dramatically, and so I got notice of class action lawsuit. Well, it settled a while later, and the stock went up about 30 or 50 cents, okay? Then a few months later, the stock dropped $2 after the settlement, okay? So I did not believe I was well served by that. I did not believe that any of the other stockholders were well served, and I think that the process simply enriched the few at the expense of the many. That seemed to be the result. In addition to that, the additional threat of lawsuits to other companies probably drove up the price of other things I buy. So the net result was, when I look at this from a different perspective, is this threat of lawsuit and the settlement simply enriches the attorney firm and drives up the cost for everybody else. That was my experience in participating in a class action lawsuit. And I see this bill as limiting that type of action. Would that be correct?
I believe that would be accurate.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill that we haven't heard from? Representative Simon, you have one question, and then...
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I know I've said enough, probably, but I will point out, for those who are concerned about class actions, it is true that Section 3 is addressed solely to class actions, but Section 2 isn't. It goes way beyond just class actions. So anyone in any other context who wants to make use of these listed statutes, whether in a class action or not, would be affected by this. I just want members to know that. So if I or any other group wants to go ahead under these statutes, they would be affected whether or not they use the vehicle of the class action under Section 2 of the bill. I just want to make sure we understand. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask for a roll call of the bill.
Simon asked for a roll call. A roll call will be taken. Members, with no further questions, thank you for a good discussion and lots of input from the audience and members. We'll move to take a vote on this bill as amended. The clerk will take the roll to renew. First of all, Representative Wardlow renews his motion to pass House File 211 as amended and refer it to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved.
Representative Westrum?
Yes.
Representative Drazkowski?
Yes.
Representative Lesh?
Nope.
Representative Grunhagen?
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom?
No.
Representative Hilty?
No.
Representative Holberg?
Yes.
Representative Hoppe?
Yes.
Representative Hortman?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mazerall?
Yes.
Representative Pepin?
Yep.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Runbeck?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wardlow?
Yes.
Having 10 yes, 7 no, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Wardlow. And next we've got Representative Anderson. Bruce, you want to come forward and present your bill? Representative Drazkowski will move House File 250 be recommended to pass and re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Anderson, you want to tell us about your bill? And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
What it does.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for the opportunity to come before your committee. House File 250
just
is...
Just 1 second, Representative Anderson. I think there's some people leaving. If people... If you're vacating, if you could leave, then we can keep the room a little quieter, or please try to vacate quietly if you're not here for this bill. Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 250 is before you regarding claims against the state of Minnesota. I, along with several members of your committee who have been on the claims committee before, Representative Simon, Representative Lesh, we're dealing with situations where we get claims brought to us, to the state, to the House, the Joint Subcommittee on Claims, House and Senate, regarding basically a lot of people from the prisons and people who have been in a situation where while on a state job have been injured. And we're just asking this to clarify the law a little bit better and to bring some clarity to this provision that's in statute regarding the existing provision of law providing for governmental immunity in these claims. If you read the amendment, we have excluded in one section of the law a portion of that where it talks about loss, damage, or destruction of property of a patient or inmate of a state institution. And, Mr. Chair, we have brought an amendment to amend that into another portion of the law. So I'd like to move, if I could, to get the bill in the order that I'd like to have it, to move the A11-0059 amendment.
Representative Anderson, I think we have to have a member of the committee move it. Representative
Chair,
Holberg?
I'd be happy to move the amendment.
Representative Holberg moves the A11-0059, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Go ahead, Representative Anderson. Thank you. Excuse me. All in favor of amending the bill, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The bill is amended in front of you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindeke, Craig Lindeke from the Revisor's Office, who would like to explain a little bit and just further broaden the dynamic of what the bill will do. And so if I could have him speak to it, I'd appreciate if that would be okay.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Mr. Lindeke, if you'd represent or if you would introduce yourself and your affiliation, please, for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Craig Lindeke from the Revisor of Statutes Office, and for the past approximately 20 years, I've been counsel to the Subcommittee on Claims, and it's been, of course, a delightful job, very interesting, as those of you who have been on the committee know. This year, we represent Senator Latz, who was the Senate Chair, and Representative Coonan, who was the House Chair, asked me to look at issues related to the Claims Subcommittee and possibly draft amendments to various features of the law that seemed to have come up that were a problem. Not a big problem. This is not a major or very important bill. They were just minor problems. So I did that, and the subcommittee itself chose not to adopt those and put them onto an upcoming claims bill. Instead, ultimately, Senator Latz asked me if I could go ahead and just draft those three things into a bill. He'd be happy to introduce it, and to his credit, Representative Anderson, who has been the chair of the subcommittee in the past and was on the subcommittee this last year, took it and became the author of the bill in the House. And here are the three things that we're doing. They're all fairly minor items. And I'm afraid that I'm probably responsible for all three of them. I don't know that anybody told me to do these things. It's just that once I brought them up, Senator Latz said, let's put them into a bill. The first one is something in 3.736, which is the Tort Claims Act. Now, that is not related to what the Committee on Claims does. It's lawsuits against the state. These are things that you go to the Attorney General's office and are ultimately resolved in court if the people aren't happy. And among the exclusions in the Tort Claims Act, things that people cannot sue the state for, And let me read you the lead-in words. Without intent to preclude the courts from finding additional cases where the state and its employees should not, in equity and good conscience, pay compensation. So these are things that they're telling us, in equity and good conscience, the state shouldn't pay for. One of those items was loss, damage, or destruction of property of a patient or inmate of a state institution. Well, over all the years I've been on the Subcommittee on Claims, we a number of times actually put into a bill, but more often than not, tell the department to pay claims for property that is damaged or destroyed by the state institution. So we know that in equity and good conscience, we're telling people to pay these claims all the time, normally to prison inmates, although out of, let's say, 100 inmate claims, we may only direct the Department of Corrections to actually pay one or two of them. But the Department of Corrections on its own pays dozens and dozens more that don't come to us. So it just seemed wrong to say in equity and good conscience we couldn't pay for this. So my idea was to take it out of the tort claims exceptions because it looked so awkward there. And then the Department of Corrections and the person of Randy Hartnett, who is the person who comes to the claims subcommittees, said, yes, but this means that they'll be able to come to a small claims court. They have plenty of time. and we'll have to have a lawyer there to represent the Department of Corrections on each one of these. So if you could somehow move it over like the injury and death claims and have it have the only available place for them to go on these would be the legislature in the form of the claims subcommittee, as it turns out, that would be good. And that's what the language in the amendment here does. It winds up taking these things and instead putting them over in this section that says that the only remedy for these people on their lost property is going to be coming to the legislature the way they do now. So nothing changes. It's just that we take it out of the Tort Claims Act where it looked so awkward. All right, that's section one of the bill and the amendment. The second item is section 3.739, and this relates only to injuries and death, which we haven't had one of yet, but injuries for people who are out doing sentencing to service work and community work service, something that we want to encourage the counties to do. And as a result, we pay for the medical expenses and permanent partial disabilities of people who are injured doing this kind of work. So starting in 1984, the amount of money was $500. Claims of $500 or less, the Department of Corrections in this case can just pay. They can pay the provider. So here's someone who's been injured. An ambulance has taken the person to the local hospital. Some doctors have treated the person. There may not even be a permanent partial disability, but anything over $500 for any one claim, and they have to wait until after the bill passes the legislature and after July 1st to pay the ambulance expenses and things like that. Well, $500 was 1984, and I indexed that, and it's over $1,000 now. So I thought the good thing to do here would be to raise that from $500 to $1,000 so that some of these medical providers could get paid more quickly. And we wouldn't have to have all of these coming to the claims subcommittee. So we just raised that amount of money. The third thing is another very minor item, and this is something that was conceived by Representative Connie Morrison in 1994. She thought that two things happened that year. One, we had been getting claims for one candy bar from prisoners. I mean, they've got a lot of time, and if they feel that someone is a guard has somehow taken their candy bar when doing a pack up and they didn't get it back when they got out of segregation, then they would put in a claim for that. Well, the claims subcommittee in its rules said you can't file for anything less than $10. So that was one minor solution to the problem. The other solution that Representative Connie Morrison came up with was if you're going to file a claim, you're going to have to pay something. You're going to have to pay a fee. And the fee was $5. And it did get enacted by the legislature and is law. It is section 3.749. And after this many years, even though when I index it, I'm not sure that it comes up to $10, it seemed like that since this is intended to be a disincentive to filing minor property claims, that raising the fee might not be a bad idea. So I wrote $10. I don't know what other people would like to have be the amount of money. The money goes to the filing fee goes to the general fund through the LCC. And if the person wins on his claim or her claim, and a number of people who are like the injury claimants, and other people who aren't related at all to the prison system, claimants from against other departments, these people, if they win their claims, they get their fee back. So if you win your claim or any part of your claim, you get your fee back. So we're only talking about the people who come to the claims subcommittee. There will be 100 claims a year, of which 90 are from the prisons, and of those 90, probably 80 of those are property claims, and most of them are denied. And it's those people mostly who are going to lose a little bit more money by having to file to pay a little bit higher filing fee.
Okay, questions for Mr. Lindeke? Any questions at all? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindeke, has there been any data at all on the cost of running this program? Or, I mean, is the filing fee at all in relation to the cost of bringing a claim?
Mr. Lindeke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, it's nice to see you back again after being gone a while. I think that this is, you know, obviously filing a fee causes, I mean, filing a claim on a minor property issue, and then we get 80 of them, involves a significant amount of time in the LCC office. It's a significant amount of time to the Department of Corrections in sending over all of the documents. And I mean, there'll be a claim that'll be a one-page claim for, you know, my lost Nikes, and we get 15 or 20 or 30 or sometimes 100 pages of stuff from the department on every property inventory and all that stuff, plus their letter that they send us in which they recommend denial. And then I have to spend time on that. The LCC makes copies for every member of the subcommittee, and I know that in the case of Representatives Simon and Lesch, they read every claim that came to them, so they spend time on it. There's a lot of time spent on a lot of minor claims, but how much it costs, I have no idea. But that's an awful lot of time on a lot of minor claims.
Representative Runbeck?
Mr. Chair, and then Mr. Lindeke, it was just a thought that maybe there ought to be at least some relationship, and maybe someone would think about looking into the whole cost of the program, and if need be, then, you know, perhaps raising the fee even a little more.
Mr. Lindeke or Representative Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, there has been talk, and I just talked with the Representative Lindeke, because he's been here long enough. But Mr. Lindeke had talked about having the fee higher than that because of all the time that does go into it and the resources that we do put into it, not only here in with Mr. Lindeke and others in the LCC, but also through the DOC. And there was talk of having a fee going much higher than what we're advocating right here today, but for the sake of not being too greedy, we were looking at $10 at this time. But if the committee has a better recommendation, we're always open to whatever the committee would like.
Other questions for Representative Anderson or Mr. Lindeke? None whatsoever. Seeing none, I would renew my motion to recommend that the bill pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Members, I believe we've finished our agenda today. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.